So let me talk to you for a minute about how my week started on this Monday. I work in a controlled environment. Not all of you do. In fact, I know a lot of you work on a hot, dusty job site, or maybe in a loud, wet kitchen. You know how hard it can be to communicate clearly. Sometimes it probably seems impossible, but I've got the solution. Post-it Extreme Notes. Now you can get your message across and get the job done in literally any weather condition, including rain or heat or humidity. New Post-it Extreme Notes are water resistant, and they're made with DuraHold paper and adhesive, so they will stick to just about anything: concrete, drywall, raw wood, even brick. So no matter what the task on the job site is, get your message across with new Post-it Extreme Notes. You can buy them today wherever you get your Post-it notes. Once again, I'm working in a climate-controlled studio. I know, I'm soft like that. You might not be, but that's your solution. Post-it Extreme Notes.
Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
So it's Monday, but why don't we go back to Saturday night? Why don't we go back to specifically right after the third round of the Masters had wrapped up? Rory McIlroy had just shot 65, but he was not done firing. In fact, he was just getting started. He hits the press room, and he goes to work on Patrick Reed, who led by three. Quote, "I feel like all the pressure is on him." Rory, with some psychological warfare, and he kept it right on going. Quote, "He's got to go out and protect that lead. And he's got a few guys chasing him that are big-time players. He's got to deal with and sleep on tonight. I feel like I can go out there and play like I've got nothing to lose." McIlroy went on, quote, "Patrick is going for his first major. I am going for something else. I've got a lot of experience in these positions." End quote. All right, so I see the guy working. And you know what? It seemed pretty convincing. It seemed pretty convincing that the popular sentiment was Rory would come back from three shots back. He'd finish off Reed, the Masters, the career Grand Slam on Sunday. After all, he's right. He had been there before. Reed had never faced the pressure of a Sunday major, let alone a Masters Sunday. And the thought was, it's going to crush this guy. Of course, anybody who thought that does not know Patrick Nathaniel Reed. Because Patrick Reed eats that crap up. Remember, this is the guy who used to allegedly introduce himself by saying, "I'm Patrick Reed, and I'll kick the bleep out of you at golf anytime you want." Literally would tell people things like that. So Patrick Reed literally spent his morning as the leader of the Masters watching the Golf Channel and seeing one guy after another lay out why Rory would win and Reed would not. Literally everybody he saw said it except Nota Begay. And Reed loved it. Quote, "It just seemed like the pressure at that point was kind of lifted off. No one expected me to go out and win." End quote. Right. He hadn't won a major yet. And yes, he theoretically had the home course advantage because he went to Augusta State, but this guy was not the fan favorite. In fact, far from it. They weren't exactly rooting for him to win, and they were practically rooting for him to lose. Think about that for a minute. I mean, that's unheard of in golf, and especially at Augusta. At Augusta, Rory was their guy. I mean, that had to have been an absolute kick in the junk to Reed. He wins back-to-back national titles right up the road, but the gallery was completely behind the guy from Northern Ireland. Should have been a kick in the junk, but it wasn't. Because not only did Reed not crack underneath it, he fed off it. It's a big fuel guy. As big a fuel guy as you'll ever find, and he was loaded with super premium yesterday. But, when Reed put his drive on one into a tree and then bogeyed the first hole while Rory parted, it looked like the door was wide open. And when Rory outdrove Reed by a country mile on two and then had a five-footer for eagle and a tie, it looked like Rory was going to blow right by him and never even look back. Except it was Rory who missed the putt. And while he did make birdie to get within one, he never got any closer than that. Instead, it was McIlroy who cracked under the pressure of Sunday at the Masters. It was Rory who ran his mouth and couldn't back it up. Reed was the one who kept right on grinding. None of that bothered Reed. Nothing bothered him. especially McIlroy, who was never a factor. Rory never bothered to get out of the courtesy van that dropped him off there. Except Reed, nothing bothered that guy. Brass as hell. Not even Jordan Spieth, who started the day 9 shots back and came charging all the way back to get into a tie for the lead after a birdie on 16. Nearly a round for the ages. But the thing about Reed, he bounced right back. He retakes the lead. Ricky Fowler made his charge. Reed held him off too. Three of the very best in the world were coming at this guy. The guy that McIlroy said would choke, and he didn't. He knew he had to keep it in his dome. He knew he had to keep his dome. Reed said, quote, "It definitely was not easy today. I knew it was going to be a dogfight. It's just a way of God basically saying, let's see if you have it. Everyone knows you have it physically with the talent, but can you do it mentally? Can you handle the ups and downs throughout the round?" End of quote. And isn't that the truth about this guy? I mean, we can get into why people don't like him, why he's so polarizing, but nobody has ever doubted this guy's talent. I mean, nobody's ever doubted how good this guy is. Sometimes his approach has been doubted, what he said, what he's done, but nobody's ever doubted what this guy could do physically. But there may have been a question about his mental game, and not anymore. Because Rory tried to play mind games with him, Jordan made a run at him, Ricky made a run at him, and none of it mattered. Patrick Reed just kept on doing what he does in the Ryder Cup, making more clutch shots and more clutch putts when they matter the most.
Patrick Reed collects himself. He has this par putt to win the Masters. Takes one more look down the line. Ball on its way, and it's in. Patrick Reed with a par at 18. A big hug with his caddy. He holds off all challengers. Doffs his cap to the patrons. Rory McIlroy walks over to congratulate him. And Patrick Reed has won the 82nd Masters.
It's Westwood One. Boy, you want to talk about a golf clap. When guys win that event, there usually is a roar and an explosion. That's not what that was. You know why? They didn't want him to win. You know what else? He doesn't give a damn. And nor would I. Look, he knew how this was going to end before you did. He believed in himself before you did. And no, this guy's not going to be your most popular winner ever. But again, who cares? I know he doesn't. Rory, Jordan, especially Ricky would have hyped the patrons. As far as Ricky Fowler, man, look out if that guy ever does win a major. That guy could not be any more popular. They couldn't want him any more than they did. If and when he gets his, look the hell out. There was none of that reaction yesterday. But Reed didn't care, and Reed was not going to let any of those guys win. He just was not let it going to happen. And when he finally did get it, and this is all part of it, he kept referring to it as, quote, "my first green jacket," as if to say, "oh, I'm going to win more of these now. If you're pissed about this, you're really going to be angry because I plan on winning another one or more." And me personally, I'm not going to bet against this guy. And finally, when it was said and done, his caddy said to him, quote, "great bleeping job. It may not have been pretty, but you got the job done." Yes and yes. It was not that pretty, but man, it was brass and it was gutty. And it was a great bleeping job. Captain America is your Masters champion. And if you're looking for him to apologize for anything, he's not going to. Dude was brass. He was brass. I like the guy. I like him a lot. I don't know what happened in college. I don't know what happened when he transferred. I've only seen all the speculation and stories. You know, as far as him and his family, it's none of my business. I don't care. I like what I saw yesterday. The guy's brass. Alan Shipnook is my guest. Alan, it's so good to have you back. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. All right. So, Alan, let me start first with this notion of pressure. Pressure was one of the big topics yesterday, and it started Saturday with Rory McIlroy talking about how all the pressure was going to be on Patrick Reed. Overall, how different is the pressure of the Masters versus the pressure of any other tournament or really any other major?
Yeah, it just gets in the head of these guys because they want it so much. It's such a coveted thing to be the Masters champ. You get the silly little jacket. You get to go to the dinner on Tuesday night. You get to come back every year for the rest of your life and be celebrated. And of course, the other major championships move around at different venues, and the Masters always comes back to Augusta National. So you're walking in the footsteps of Gene Sarazen and Jack Nicklaus on down the list. So it's just a special thing. And it's interesting because it's the smallest field by far of any of the major championships. And when you take out the amateur past champs, there's only 60 guys you have to beat, whereas at the PGA Championship, there's probably 140 guys that have a chance. So in some ways, it's the easiest of all the majors to win, but because of the scar tissue and the emotional weight these guys put on it, it's by far the most difficult one to grab.
Rolling through this Monday, and today's episode is brought to you by Fan Exchange. Hey, listen, are you thinking about buying tickets to your favorite sports, concert, or theater event? Maybe you want to experience a basketball game courtside rather than on your couch. Maybe you go to a hockey game and you bang on the glass instead of your own TV in your own living room. Then head on over to FanExchange.com for a safe, easy, and reliable experience. Tickets purchased on FanExchange are always guaranteed. There's no getting to the gate and worrying about getting in. So whether it's NBA, Major League Baseball, WrestleMania, Coachella, maybe a Broadway musical, FanExchange will get you closer to the action. Find the very best seats at the best prices at FanExchange.com. Use the promo code Rome, and you'll get 50% off the service fees on your next purchase. Fan Exchange. We have tickets. That's Fan Exchange. Alan Chipnook joining us. All right, so Reed said after the game, Alan, or after the round, that pretty much everybody was picking Rory to win, and he liked that because he felt like it took some of the pressure off of him, but then he gets off to a slightly shaky start. What do you make of the way he bounced back quickly?
You know, he didn't play great. His first three rounds were terrific. All three rounds, he'd never broken 70 before at the Masters. He did it Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Sunday, he just kind of held on, but he hit the shots when he had to, and he made the putts. It wasn't a beautiful round of golf, but it was gritty, and he had an answer. You know, people kept spurting up the board, whether it was Jordan Spieth or John Rahm, Ricky Fowler, and every time they inched closer, you know, Reed answered. It was impressive. And, you know, the notion of who had the pressure or not, I mean, the fact is three strokes is a significant advantage. You know, if Reed shot 71 like he did, that meant someone's got to shoot 67 to beat him. I mean, that's a heck of a round on Sunday at the Masters. So I think there was, you know, a little bit of verbal positioning and jousting that didn't reflect the reality. I mean, Reed had a cushion, and he knew it, and he played like that. He played a little conservatively, but ultimately he did exactly what he had to do.
And then I'll go back to Rory in a minute. But, you know, in Reed, Alan, if you've written about him, he's kind of a different guy, certainly polarizing. And from afar, it seemed like the roars were a lot louder for Ricky, Rory, and Jordan than they were for Patrick. He says that really does not bother him. Do you buy that, or do you think maybe it does sting a little bit and he uses it as fuel and motivation?
I think it's both. I think it does bother him, and he does use it as fuel. On the other hand, he kind of likes, he's always been an outsider. That's the Patrick Reed story. And, you know, I wrote a big piece for golf.com that's up there now. And even going back to junior golf, he was this cocky, brash kid who played, much like Tiger, played against older kids and regularly beat them. And he was never really accepted by his peers because he loved rubbing in their face. And so then he goes to University of Georgia, and he bombs out after a year because he couldn't get along with his teammates and some other controversies. Goes to Augusta State. His teammates there hated him. And yet, in a weird way, he rallied them together. They had so much antipathy for Reed. They were kind of bonded together. And he was such a good player. They won two national championships because and in spite of him at the same time. And so all that baggage followed him out on the tour, and he's always been an outsider. He's never felt accepted by the golf community. You know, he's rough around the edges, and, you know, half the guys on tour, it seems like, from the University of Georgia, they don't get along with him. And so he's always had this identity, and that's why he's been so good at the Ryder Cup. He can channel that. He's used to having people pull against him. And it was a paradox because as much game as he's shown in the Ryder Cup, you know, he only had five career wins. It seemed like he should have been a guy who won a lot more, and he just seemed like he couldn't find the same intensity week to week. But I think having the crowd against them, everyone pulling for Rory and Jordan and Ricky, I think that helped. I helped in the final analysis. I think that helped Reed on Sunday at the Masters.
We're talking Alan Chipnook. You know, it's that same piece that you have up right now on golf.com. You talked to Ryan Moore and Webb Simpson, Daniel Berger. What did they make of Reed?
You know, he's a curiosity even to them. Reed plays all his practice rounds alone. He has this very tight, insular family unit. You know, his brother-in-law is his caddy. His sister-in-law is the nanny. The mother-in-law travels with him, helps take care of the baby, and kind of serves as the chief of staff. And that's it. No one else is allowed in their world. And they're very tribal. You know, they're kind of like Irish travelers. You know, they move in a pack, and no one can penetrate Team Reed, and they like that. They thrive on that. You know, they all kind of have a chip on their shoulder, and you know, his wife Justine, I think, feeds kind of that outsider's perspective and sense of grievance with the world and the golf community. And so, yeah, they're really, I mean, Patrick can be charming. He really can. And I think on tour, a lot of guys like him, sort of, but they just don't really know him. And I think he likes it that way.
We're talking Alan Chipnook. All right, Alan, so what about Rory? Rory talked a lot on Saturday about putting that pressure on Reed, and then he comes out and he followed through on the first two holes, and then he faded away. What happened to Rory yesterday?
It was a brutal performance. This one's going to haunt him for a long time. I mean, he already had a star-crossed history at Augusta National. You know, that the course is just taking his lunch money and pulled down his pants a few times, and this is one of the worst ones yet. I mean, you know, the first hole, the Rory's big advantage over Reed is he's so much longer off the tee. And if Reed from 150 yards in is better than Rory. So if McIlroy, three shots back, was going to win this Masters, he needed an overpowering performance off the tee. He needed to get into Reed's head. He needed to be 80 yards down the fairway every hole and let Reed think about that. You know, Rory steps up, crowd goes crazy for him. And he fans his first drive almost into the merchandise tent. It's the worst drive I've literally ever seen Rory McIlroy hit in competition. It was off the planet. He saved a miraculous par, but that was a telling moment. And even though he birdied the second hole, I mean, he had, a five-footer for eagle. That would have been his statement. That would have sent those roars cascading through the pines. And if you're trying to reel in somebody and you're trying to get in their head, you can't miss a putt like that. And all of a sudden, Rory got, because of that swing on the first tee and that putt on the second hole, he got very defensive, and you could just see it. He had no belief in what he was doing out there, and he played awful. By the back nine, he was an afterthought. I mean, this was the guy who everyone was, it was going to be a coronation. This was going to be the missing piece in his resume. He'd become only the sixth player ever to win the Grand Slam, and he just slipped on the banana peel. I mean, it was hard to watch, and it really. Rory's at a crossroads. I mean, he hasn't won a major since 2014. He's dealt with a lot of stuff on and off the golf course, and everybody wants him to be the player he was because he can bring so much electricity to a golf tournament, but he's getting passed by a lot of players, and that was really a devastating showing for him.
I mean, so laying it out the way you just did and looking at the conditions, I mean, is that anything other than nerves?
It's completely nerves. I mean, it's Augusta fever. It just got in his head. I mean, he'd been playing beautifully in the run-up to the Masters. You know, he had a great performance at Bay Hill, 64 on Sunday, dominant victory. The first three rounds of this Masters was the most controlled, calculating, kind of pressure-proof golf he had played. You know, it was really pretty easy three rounds for Rory. He looked great on the greens. He just looked in control of himself, and he's never appeared or so relaxed and never sounded so good in the press conferences, saying all the right things. And he went out there on Sunday, and he just flat out, he just didn't get it done. And, it's a troubling pattern. You know, Augusta exposes all his weaknesses on the greens, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. And I really, at this point, you have to question if Rory's ever going to break through at the Masters and complete that Grand Slam.
Alan Chipnook, my guest. Alan, one last thought. I could talk to you about 10 or 12 other things. You and I have talked in the past about one of my favorite guys ever, Anthony Kim. I don't know what it is, Alan. I can't watch that event without thinking about this guy. Every single year at this time, I'm like, I wonder what Anthony Kim is up to. He is such a fascinating character. And it's been 9 years now since that amazing round at Augusta where he had 11 birdies. Back in 2014, you had a great piece about him and trying to figure out that mystery. When was the last time you heard or saw anything from Anthony Kim?
Well, after that story, he resurfaced and, you know, did a quick phone interview with the Associated Press. And that was, those were his last public comments. You know, he shows up on social media occasionally in very random ways, but, and because I wrote that story, people are always tweeting or whatever, their sightings to me. I saw him at Costco. I saw him at the Champagne Room at Little Darlings, you know, whatever it may be. And, you know, he's out there living life, but the golf world has certainly moved on. I think AK has accepted at this point that his run is over. But it's really sad because he could have been the American McIlroy. They played a very similar game, hyper-aggressive, pile up birdies like crazy, just shoot for every flag, similar kind of charisma, and really the same amount of game. I mean, and they're about the same age. I mean, Anthony Kim could be what Rory McIlroy is, but he just didn't want it enough, and he had the proverbial distraction with a capital D. He had injuries. There was this big insurance payment that was waiting for him if he walked away from the game, and much like Patrick Reed, Anthony Kim never fit in on the PGA Tour. He was constantly getting fined for all his little indiscretions. The uptight, you know, country club Republicans just didn't really get his vibe and didn't appreciate what he brought to the tour. And he felt like an outsider too. And he just kind of got tired of the whole thing. And you know, he's still a young guy. If he could wake up one day and decide he wants to play golf again, I mean, who knows? But every day that goes by, that becomes more and more of a fairy tale. So I'm sorry, Jim. I think it's time to, you need to move on. You know, it's like a high school girlfriend you're still pining for. It's just time to let go.
Dude, I can't. That's the whole point, man. I'm still looking for the guy. I wish that I was the guy that ran into him in Costco. I wish that I ran into him at Little Darlings. I wish I could find this guy. In fact, Alan, I'm not going to lie to you. I've got a few phone numbers for him. And every once in a while it's not a drunk dial, I'll pull out the phone and thumb out a text to him to see if I can get him to respond. So, yeah, I know I should turn the page, Alan, but I haven't. And almost guaranteed the next time you and I speak, I probably will bring it up again at the end of the interview. He's a columnist for golf.com and a senior writer for Golf Magazine. Alan Shipnick, my guest. Alan, great job, man. Great talking to you, as always. Thank you.
Yeah, but one thing you got to know is he had about 6 burner phones back in the day, so I'm not
right.
Sure any of those numbers.
That's why he's not responding. I know it. And I've got about 4 of the numbers, and that's why he's not responding. Speaking of Rory, however, somebody's got to go tell Rory that we all missed him yesterday in the final round of the Masters. Somebody tell him that if you can find him. He might be harder to find than Anthony Kim at this point. Rory was supposed to tee it off at 2:40 local time. But the dude that talked all that junk Saturday about how the pressure was on Pat Reed, that guy never showed. More likely, it was some hack who was not ready for prime time to run down a first-timer, pegging it up at number one, and punted a ball to hell on a dead 45-degree angle. You heard Shipnook say it. That was the worst drive he has ever seen Rory hit, ever, in his career. And that's how that guy's round started. And it ended with a meaningless par at 18 to lock up a 4-way tie for 5th. This was supposed to be a re-rack of that epic singles match at Hazeltine in 2016. The one where Rory went WWE heel and Reed earned the gloss Captain America. The one where those two dudes were throwing haymakers for 18 holes before Reed finished Rory on the 18th to win one up. It was supposed to be that, but better. Because Ryder Cup singles matches are great, but they're not Sunday at Augusta. Not with the green jacket on the line, and not with the one guy calling out the other guy the night before. And with all the hype in the world going into yesterday's final pairing, Rory doesn't even show. The dude that fired a 65 on Saturday and put himself 3 back to start Sunday and had a chance to tie early with a very makeable eagle putt nowhere to be found. Saturday, Rory was dialed in. Sunday, Rory was a loose wreck. Saturday, Rory could not miss with a putter. Sunday, he shouldn't have even bothered. And after that bogey on 11, put him 2 over for the day, CBS suddenly stopped showing him. Probably not a better barometer of how you're doing than the amount of TV run you get. 11 holes in, 11 holes into the final round, in the final pairing, and CBS was not going to waste valuable real estate on Rory. Can't say that I blame them. Not when Jordan was charging. Not when Rahm was making his move. Not when Fowler started to make his charge. And there's Pat Reed. Not playing great. Not dominating. But still pacing everybody out front. Doing what he had to do. Rory? I mean, come on. This guy shot himself out of the career slam by the turn. There's not a more maddening game out there than golf. Sometimes you have it. Sometimes you don't. But the greats can find a way to summon it when they have to have it. And this guy couldn't do it. This guy couldn't do it. And watching him yesterday, and it was hard to watch, it makes you wonder if, in fact, this guy's ever going to get it done there. Because yesterday, it was right there for him. All set up. Starting with that eagle putt. Knocked that thing in, and he arguably runs right by Reed. Because the gallery goes crazy. But he couldn't do it. The dude was running down history, trying to run, trying to join the most exclusive company in golf as the sixth player ever and the first European to win every single major. And it was right there. I mean, again, make no mistake, that guy was right there. He would have signed up to be three shots off the lead on Sunday at every single Masters, especially if he's chasing a first-timer who he outdrives by like 50 yards or more. But no matter how that thing was set up, how well it was set up, he could not cash it in. And you know what else? He no-showed on the very same world stage that he said that Reed would fall right through. Except it was Rory who was nowhere to be found. And then afterwards, Rory said he's got to stay positive because he played well this week. He came in off a win at Bay Hill. Yeah, all true. But playing well and coming in off a win does not put a green jacket in your closet. And no amount of spin will. Next time, save your psychological warfare for somebody who it will work on. Because right now, Reed is just laughing. Just as Rory should know that he may never have as good a look at that green jacket as he did yesterday. It took this guy 7 years just to get back to a final pairing at the Masters. And he blew it again. So don't get it twisted. This is about Reed winning it. It's not about McIlroy losing it, but it's also about one guy who had never been there before showing up and the guy running his mouth who had been there before and not getting it done. It all came back to bite him in the back. Bad day, bad look, bad showing. And those demons, man, they're so much bigger now. He may not make it back. And the guy who's got it just kept talking about winning his first green jacket. Wouldn't surprise me at all if he got another one at all. Ice Cube is my guest. Cube, it's good to have you back. How are you?
What's up, Jim? How you doing, man?
Good, man. How about you? How are things?
Oh, man, I'm great. Everything is going good.
Listen, you've got your Big Three draft coming up on Wednesday. Actually, the combine is Wednesday. The draft is Thursday. So how pumped are you to get another season underway?
I'm excited, man. You know, that's the best part is seeing these guys go at it. I mean, we got to do all this stuff behind the scenes to get ready for the season, but just to see guys go at it, you know, as a fan, that's really what I'm in it for, is to see dudes who still got the desire to give them a platform and for us to be able to enjoy it.
All right, so Keith, what about the draft itself? I mean, you're going to run your draft a little bit differently than the way most leagues handle their drafts. How does it work for the defending champs trilogy and then for every other team?
Well, you know, just starting off, we started with five players last year, but we're adding a sixth player. We let the captains of the teams pick another co-captain. So each team has two co-captains now. So they have to get all the other players from the draft pool, but not with the champions. The champions, they have to defend. They cannot draft. They cannot make any moves like that. Our runner-ups, they got two options. The first option, they can send everybody back to the draft pool, or they can keep their whole team intact, but they got to send one player back. Now, if you finish third all the way to eighth, all your draft players go back to the pool, and you got to redraft. So you may have new players or maybe other players you need. But the whole thing is to knock off the champs. You got to put a team together that's going to be able to go after Trilogy. So it's fun. It allows new players to always join the draft pool. And, you know, to keep it churning, to keep it interesting. You don't want to see the exact same teams you saw last year. So it's a cool way to keep it fresh.
Ice Cube joining us, and it's going to be a big week for that league. You know, Cube, you look at earlier this year, the Celtics signed Xavier Silas to a 10-day contract. He was playing in your league for the Ball Hogs, and now he makes the NBA. Look, I know it's the Celtics. I know you're a Lakers guy, obviously, but how proud were you to have somebody go from your league to the NBA?
Oh, that's big. Oh, man, you know, that's huge because people think or thought this was considered, I guess, the old guys' league, but no, these are guys, some guys feel like they've been, like, rejected from the NBA too early. Or, you know, only a few guys get to go out like Kobe, where you just, you know, sign your own ticket how you want to end your career. Most guys don't even know they retired. They're just out. So guys have a hunger to still show that they got it. Josh Powell, he got invited to the Nuggets training camp. So that was the first inkling of, yo, you can use the big three to actually get back in the NBA. And so to have Xavier Silas get that 10-day contract with the Celtics is big for our league on credibility. It's big for players to look at us as a viable option like they look at Europe or Asia. So, you know, it's really a milestone in our league's development.
Yeah, Cube, also you made the point that you don't want the teams to look exactly the same. You don't want the league to look the same. You don't want the players to look the same. So you've added guys like Baron Davis, Amari Stoudemire, Meta World Peace, and Greg Oden. How big of a step do you think that's going to be for the league this year?
Huge. You know, it's a humongous step because a lot of players, you know, sat on the sideline last year and watched, you know, and saw, you know, is this league for real? Is it legit? Is it done first class? And when they realized it was, you know, they wanted to be a part of it, and that's what it's all about. You know, we're going to be here. So whenever you get the itch, you know, all the players out there that's looking at us, whenever you get the itch, we're here. And come, you know, come to our combine, show what you got or what you still got, and hopefully you make a squad, you know. And we expect to expand next year and add more teams in success. You know, that's our plan.
Combine's Wednesday. The draft is Thursday. Key, what about a guy like, say, Paul Pierce? Is that a guy that you could see committing to it and doing it?
Man, we've been recruiting Paul Pierce heavy. But, you know, I'm not sure. I don't think he's going to play. You know, he's probably having too much fun with that cushy job he got right now. So, but look, we'll be here next year if you get the itch. And that's the thing about the big three. We're always here. You know, our oldest player was Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. Sorry about that. And he is 48 years old, and he was still serving him 20. He was still, you know, getting buckets, doing his thing, you know, with guys out there 30, you know, 5, 36 years old. So, you know, our league is going to get younger this year. You know, we expect it to be an average age of 33, and you have to be 30 to be in our league. So it's pretty cool, you know, to still be recruiting dudes and going after them. But, you know, we wanted to get Paul. I don't know if we're going to get him this year.
Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, Cube, is a guy that I had on the show within the past year. Always one of my favorites. Glad to see him still out there balling. Hey, before I let you go, let me ask you about the Lakers. They're going to end the season with their most wins since 2013. How are you feeling about the direction of that team right now? Does it feel to you like they've turned the corner?
No. Feels like they got work to do, you know. They are in a nice spot. I think we got good pieces. But, you know, I don't want people to feel like, yo, we've, you know, turned some kind of corner. You know what I mean? It's really, you know, turning the corner is making the playoffs. So until then, we're still building to what we need to be. So that's kind of how I look at it. But I love our progress, and I love our new players like Kuzma, and I love Ball. I love Brandon Ingram. All these guys are great. And man, Randall is a beast. You know, I've always known that kid was going to turn into what he is. So it's really coming together well. I'm happy with the leadership over there. I always thought Jenny Buss was the person who should be running the whole thing over there. And so it's going in the right direction. I think her, you know, I think the Laker Nation is feeling good. You know, we feel good. And over the last few seasons, Laker Nation was feeling a little shaky. So here we go.
Laker Nation would feel great if they can convince LeBron to come here as well. Keep, let me ask you about LeBron before I let you go. He took some heat a few weeks back after he expressed some thoughts on social and political issues. So what's your reaction when you hear somebody suggest that basketball players with views on social and political issues should, quote, just shut up and dribble?
It's ridiculous, you know. I mean, is the guy that's out there driving the truck, you expect him to just shut up and drive the truck? Or the guy that's out there delivering the mail, you expect him to shut up and just deliver the mail? So, come on, you know, this is the freedom of our country. I don't understand why we are starting to question these freedoms that we've enjoyed for generations, some of us. But so to speak, the freedom of speech has been something that we all want. Nobody want to be stifled. Nobody want to be, you know, put into a box. Nobody wants, you know, people to tell them to shut up. And you don't want it, so why would you want LeBron to do it? Or why would you want that on LeBron? So you just really got to really go back to the golden rule, man. You know, treat each other like you want to be treated. Straight up.
Ice Cube, my guest. Cube, last thought. As many people know, your son played you in Straight Outta Compton. He had another movie, Den of Thieves, come out earlier this year. He's in the new Godzilla movie coming out next summer. As a father, how much pride is there for you when you see him on screen and you see the career that he is developing and building for himself?
I mean, y'all lucky I ain't around here like LeVar Ball, yelling and acting a fool. You know, because I'm proud. You know, I'm a proud pop. You want, you know, any father would like their son to follow up in their footsteps if they're doing something positive. But so, you know, this is a great business. He's second generation Hollywood. You know, I've opened the door for him. So it's really good that he's, you know, stepping into it and you know, really having his own fans and his own, you know, persona. He's his own star, which is great. Because as a father, you just want your kids to be able to, you know, take care of themselves. And that's a great thing that he could do that.
And I certainly wanted to get to this topic, and it's critical that we get to the topic, and I was going to much sooner than later. But I want to read this email because it sets up this topic, and there are so many emails like this. Rome, small town guy in Alberta, Canada, first time ever emailing or contacting. I don't have the talk game, but listen to you for years. Love the show. Just wanted a small shout out to the Humboldt Broncos hockey team that was devastated on the weekend with a bus crash killing 15 people, injuring countless more on the way to a playoff game. Tragic, even for these kids and community. Ages 16 to 20 were the kids in the bus. Thank you for giving us a place to go to take our minds off it for a brief moment. Keep up the better than great work. Signed, Small Town Canada. And we have a number of stations and listeners in Canada. And this is not just a Canadian thing. This is one of the most horrific things I've ever seen or heard. The world of sports continues to be in shock and in mourning over what happened over the weekend in Saskatchewan. A bus with a junior hockey team, the Humboldt Broncos, and a semi-truck collided, taking the lives of 15 people, including 10 players, as they traveled to a playoff game on Friday night. I mean, an absolutely horrifying and terrifying incident. Players from the ages of 16 to 21, the pride of a small farming town roughly 60 miles from Saskatoon. I mean, it's already one of the worst things that could ever happen, but it hits even closer to home for people around the NHL. Because almost everybody in the NHL has been on that bus. They've taken that ride. You know, there's so many times where I talk about the athletes that I interview, and you never want to paint any group of people or any walk of life, of course, with any one broad stroke. But I've often said some of my favorite athletes, among the best guys to talk to, are hockey players, NHL players. And it's because a lot of them grew up like this, in these small towns, in these small communities, where they have this blue-collar work ethic and they have an amazing perspective. And they've been on that bus and they've ridden that bus so many times, long bus rides. And guys in the NHL, almost all the players in the NHL have lived that life. They know that life. And that's why it hits even closer to home there. This is a horrific thing to happen to anybody at any time, but guys in the NHL know. And nobody understands that better, for instance, than Toronto Maple Leaf coach Mike Babcock, who's a native of that area.
Good morning. First thing, obviously, being from Saskatchewan, I prepared to talk to you too, so I'd not be emotional. But you know, I grew up there, right there in Saskatoon. It's just down the road. My buddy's kid played there. Yeah, I talked to him. He's a fireman in Saskatoon last night, and as the calls were coming in, and they're talking about all the kids they've coached over the years that are playing on that team. I can't even imagine being the parent, or the wife, or the kids at home. Going through something like this. So, you know, our hearts, the hockey world's an unbelievable world. You can't make up for loss, you just can't. It's gotta rip the heart out of your chest. We pray for those families and thinking about them. And I don't know what else to say, but, you know, a horrific, horrific accident. A tough day.
Toronto Maple Leafs head coach Mike Babcock on Saturday morning. And I would echo that, too. What can you possibly say? Just absolutely devastating, horrific. I mean, virtually every junior player or minor leaguer has boarded that bus, including Edmonton star Connor McDavid. He said, quote, "Every single person, everyone in hockey, that's exactly why it hits home, because everyone has been on that bus before. It's terrifying to see that happen. It's unthinkable," end quote. It is unthinkable because every year, sons leave their homes to chase that dream. I know some who have. I mean, I'm a Los Angeles native. I live in Southern California. I know kids. I know kids. We have friends who have kids who have done that. I know so many of you listening right now know kids like that, have families like that. No matter where you live. And that dream just turned into the worst nightmare imaginable. Those families, friends of those families that lost loved ones will never be the same. Obviously. Maybe. I mean, maybe possibly in time you somehow learn to live with that. Maybe. Maybe somehow in time you learn to somehow get beyond it. But you never get over that. You never get over losing a loved one like that, especially at that age. And the response has been incredible. A GoFundMe page was set up. It's already raised nearly $5.5 million. As of last night, more than 60,000 people from nearly 60 countries around the world had pledged their money to help those families and this town move forward. So the hockey world is coming together on social media as well. People all across the globe are leaving a hockey stick outside on the front porch to honor those who are now gone. It's just a devastating story. Devastating story that people around the world are showing up to demonstrate unbelievable support and empathy for. If you want to share your thoughts, you can do so either by phone or Twitter or via email. But I think the person who sent me that email and signed it, Small Town Canada, I know there were a lot of people listening to this show that are just like this person. Marcus Allen. Marcus, great to have you on the program. How are you?
Great to be here. Feeling good.
Well, it's good to have you here. I'm glad. First, let me get your thoughts on the process. I mean, now you're about 2 weeks away from the NFL draft. How are you feeling at this point? Are you still enjoying the process? Or at this point, are you like, man, I got to find out where I'm going to live and where I'm going to work and get this thing started?
I'm not too worried on where I'm going to live or, like, you know, when I'm going to get picked. It's more like, you know, just living my life, you know, having fun with the process, taking it all in, because this is only one time. You only get this one time. And, you know, just training my butt off. You know, I've been training hard.
All right, now you know how the draft evaluation process works, right? People are going to pick your game apart, and they're going to look for any flaw they can find. So what's it like to be in the middle of this? I mean, do you understand that it's all part of the process and it's not personal, or do you see that criticism and do you take it and use it as motivation?
Oh, I definitely take it as motivation, you know, especially like the criticism, like on like social media or anything like that. Like, I take it as motivation. Like, I stated before that, like, I made a bad play once, and I got heat for it. Oh my God! Like, on social media, it went crazy, and, like, you know, people were saying crazy stuff to me. Like, you know, I just screenshotted it. You know, put it all in my little album that I have in my photo album. Put, you know, motivation folder. So I just look at things like that, and it just gets me pumped and just gets me motivated, because I know you never could get too high on your success and never get too low.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, something's really interesting to me is that you make one play, you have one play that's maybe not a great play. It happens to everybody. You go to your phone, you see it on social media, and there's just hate. I mean, hate from people that will never know you or ever meet you. But you're telling me this story, but you're not angry, and you've got a smile on your face, which is not surprising to me, because one of the things that keeps coming up from all the evaluators is how fearless and aggressive you are on the field, but how positive and upbeat you are off the field. So where does that come from? Is that your parents or something else? That mindset, that positive, upbeat mindset that you always have?
I think my positive mindset that I got, like, it just comes from, like, my family. You know, my family's full of, like, positive people. My father, my mother's sisters, my brother. Like, we all just a big, happy family. So, like, we just hang around each other. We love each other, especially, like, around Christmas. You know what I'm saying? Like, we do everything together. So far as the positive outlook of things, and with me, that's where it comes from. But, you know, my aggression on the field, you just got to be born with that. You know, I could say that I was born with that, and, like, I'm definitely aggressive. I have that mindset to, like, destroy anything that's, like, moving. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's just how I am. So I don't know. I can't really explain it. You got to be born with it.
I get that. Marcus Allen joining us. I mean, you've got that mindset. Like, you're looking to destroy anything that moves. So let me ask you about practice. Let me ask you about Saquon Barkley. You've seen him up close now for quite some time. First of all, what kind of advice would you give other NFL safeties when it comes to tackling him?
Like I said, shoot your shot. You know what I'm saying? Don't try to break down. Don't try to do all that. Because, like, he can do it all, man. I'm telling you. He can jump over you. He can make you miss. And he could, like, truck you. So it's just like, shoot your shot, go full speed. Like, that's it.
Hey, listen, you've told the story. You've told the story about what happened the first time the two of you went up against each other in practice. What happened the first time, and then what happened the second time?
All right, let me tell you the whole story.
Yeah, tell me the whole story.
All right, the first time, we was in, like, what, spring ball, I believe. It was the same practice, because, like, Saquon ain't really, like, go live like that. I was the only one, like, tackling him. So, like, it was like, he kept breaking through. So the first time he broke through, it was me and him. He could have did me dirty. He could have, like, jumped over because I went low, but he looked out.
Right.
So he just did a nice move, and he scored, because it was all goal line. This was all goal line. He scored. So then the second time, it was like he broke through, and, like, the end zone's right here. And I was coming at an angle, like the power line right there, and he was coming. It's like head up, straight head up. Just a big collision, boom. And, like, he ain't get it. I won that one. But, like, he felt that. He was on the ground. He was like, man, you hit hard. Like, he felt it. I felt it too in my neck. I ain't gonna lie.
All right, so bottom line, he didn't get in. That's the bottom line. He did not get in. Who got the worst of that?
Right.
Who got the worst of that? when you guys both got up, who got the worst of that collision?
He definitely did. Yeah.
Marcus Allen joining us. I'm glad you told me the whole story. That's great. Listen, how'd you end up at Penn State? And I bring this up because when you look at the recruiting process, when you started making a name for yourself in Maryland, you were getting a lot of interest from a lot of programs, and the thought was Pittsburgh might be where you end up because your godfather, Curtis Martin, went there. So take me back. What were your initial thoughts about Penn State when they started to recruit you?
You know, I really wasn't into Penn State like that. You know, I didn't really know that much about it because, you know, I love Pitt. I love Maryland. I was just going through the recruiting process. But once Penn State came and, like, Coach Larry Johnson was, like, recruiting me, he's such a genuine person at heart that it was like, you know, I could really see myself, like, you know, being around this type of environment. Like, especially when I went to Penn State. When you go to Penn State and you walk through them gates into Beaver Stadium, you're sold. You know what I mean? Like, nothing beats that stadium. And then an environment with the people, especially the football players that were there, you know, I felt like I grew like a relationship with them already. And I was a recruit. I was in, like, what, 11th grade, you know? So, like, it felt like it was the right decision to make. And especially, like, the education. And then it's a win-win because you got great education and great football. So it was a no-brainer.
Well, it's a no-brainer, but at the same time, when you went there and when you were looking at that program was not at that time where it is right now. In fact, if there's one moment that the fans point to in the turnaround, it's your block kick against Ohio State. You got to take me back. What do you remember about that play, and how do you feel now when people say that was the moment that Penn State football was officially back?
I mean, that's deep. You know what I mean? Like, that's definitely deep, but yeah. That play that's a legendary play right there. And, you know, when it first happened, you know, I wasn't thinking nothing like that. I wasn't thinking like, oh, man, it's going to go down in history books. You know, I'm just thinking, hey, we got to beat Ohio State, you know? And I knew we were going to get back on the field. But to tell you about the story, in the beginning, like, it was like in the first half, like, I came through and did the exact same thing, but I missed the block the first time. And then the second time in half, like, we went in halftime, and I talked to Coach Huff and Coach Spence. Coach Huff was telling me, like gave me all the corrections and, like, told me what I need to do, you know, to align it right. And, like, if they on this hash, to do it this way, and, you know what I mean, like that. And then, you know, you don't really get second chances in football like that, but, you know, God gave us a second chance. And, you know, I blocked it. It worked out, and then it was the crowd. You know, it was just crazy.
Mark Salen joining us, getting ready for the NFL draft and talking about his time at Penn State. So let me ask you this: you play football at Penn State, and that means you're part of an amazing tradition, a proud tradition. But on top of that, you were a captain at Penn State. So what did that honor mean to you? And then how would you describe your leadership style?
You know, that's a blessing. You know, to be a captain at Penn State University, like, you're talked about with, like, all the legends and all the people that were captains and stuff before you. So, I mean, that meant a lot to me, and that meant, like, it made me look at it like my teammates really look at me like they respect me and everything. So, like, when I was voted captain, you know, I was very happy. And I knew what it came with. I knew that I had to, mature even more than I already did. And, like, just lead by example. Like, that's how I lead. I don't really lead by, like, getting in your face and telling you what to do, like, rah, rah, rah stuff. That's not me. That's not my motto. But what I am going to do, I'm going to show you, you know. And the way I show it, it's like you're gonna wanna follow because I'm doing it the right way, you know, on and off the field. So that's just me.
We're talking to Marcus Allen. You know, a lot of guys, Marcus will tell you, yeah, you know, it's a once in a lifetime, so I'm just going to enjoy the process. And it sounds like it's the thing you're supposed to say, but I'm looking at what you've done since you started to get ready for the draft, so I believe you when you say it. As an example, you were part of a group from Penn State who dominated at the combine and were the talk of Indianapolis. What is it about that strength and conditioning program at Penn State that makes it special? And then how did it feel to show up and dominate like that as a group?
Oh, it felt well. It felt really good, like, because we were pushing each other, you know, like we always do, like winter workouts, the weight room, practice, extra work, anything we do at Penn State, we push each other. So I remember when Troy Apke was at the, you know, lining up at 40, I was like, hey, you know, I'm talking to him, like, getting him hype, you know, like, I'm here for you, bro, like, that, you know, do your thing, you know what I mean? Like, think about your family, like, that's how we motivate each other. So when we do that for each other, it's like we're a family. So that's how we do it with any and everything we do. So
yeah. Fine with that. It's culture, right? It's a family and it's a culture. It's got to start with the head man. What was James Franklin like to play for?
Oh, it was fun. You know, Coach Franklin, you know, he's always hype. He's always like excited, a lot of energy. You might as well call him an energy bunny. You know, Energizer Bunny.
Right.
Because, I mean, that matches me, you know what I mean? Because I'm an Energizer Bunny, because, like, I got a lot of energy. And then you could just get, like, feel his vibe, you know what I'm saying? Like, he's going to, like, make you want to, like, work out. Like, say you got a bad day today, he's going to make you want to work out and make you, like, want to have fun at practice or something like that. Like, it's contagious, you know? His energy is very contagious.
Good night now!